Hey there, Jive Turkeys, and welcome back to WSYL. This is your very groovy host, Jeff Harmon. I'm stoked this week to bring you a most radical collection of Jason and Dee's top five songs of 1975. So as you're cruising down life's highway in your shaggin' wagon, pause that 8-track, crank up the boombox to the max, have a Coke and a smile, and enjoy these out-of-sight favorites of 1975. Now, here's Jason and Dee.
Welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast, everybody. If you are tuning in because you saw the title of this video slash podcast, then I'm guessing that you've got some lower back pain that you're dealing with, and that's okay. We do too, but we're going to go back to a time when there was no back pain. There was nothing but love and rock and roll in the air. Going back to 1975, you know, people ask me, how do you have such good taste in music? And I've always wondered until I started researching this year, and I was cooking the whole year of 1975, literally from the beginning of the year until October. And I'm thinking it's because in the womb, I was being exposed to some of the greatest rock and roll albums of all time.
All right. That sounds good. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that in 1975, the day I was born, the number one song on the radio was Fame by David Bowie, which is not a bad song to have as your number one song the day you were
born.
That's
not bad. I'll tell you what the number one song was when I was born in 1973.
Yeah.
Tie a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree.
That's right.
Ah.
I was just very happy it was not Captain and Tennille. Love will keep us together.
Hey, you don't know what's coming on my list here. Let's take us back to a time before people even cared about seatbelts, right?
Right, unless you're in a gremlin. Go check out our Jimmy Buffett episode for that fantastic
story.
That's
right.
Yeah, so this is, you and I were talking earlier, the way that we do this, guys, is that we each come up with our own top five. And then we tease the songs up. We give history, stories, whatever about it to try to see if the other guy can guess which song it is. And you guys play along and you try to guess which song it is that we're thinking of. But we don't know what each other's lists are. So really, you potentially are getting like the top 10 of 1975, but just from our perspectives. And Jason just said this to me before we started. I don't think we're going to have a lot of crossover, and I agree. I don't think we will.
I don't think we will.
You're going to have different perspective on this one because my 1975 musical taste really kind of happened in 1988, 89 when I started playing guitar and going back to the classics.
When we're talking about 80s songs, I've got kind of a library of information that I kind of fall back on. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Bon Jovi and Motley Crue and Poison. I already know stuff about all those guys.
Yeah.
And so when I went back and studied these songs, not only did I not know anything about these songs, really, I didn't know anything about the band. And so this has been a real fun deep dive for me.
Absolutely.
I will be curious if you've even heard of all of my songs.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are some on there that I have not heard of. But enough of the buildup. Let's jump in. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. I'm going to let you go first because, you know, age before beauty.
I was 2 years old when this song came out. So,
all right. So we're going to start with our number five, work our way down to number two. Then we're going to give a couple of honorable mentions and then we'll tell you what our number one song is. Jason, start us off. What's your number five?
Number five.
Five.
Okay, so this song was released April 5th of 1975.
Okay.
It reached number 12 on the Hot 100. So a relatively strong showing on the Hot 100.
Mm-hmm.
Topped out June 21st, 1975, almost exactly 50 years ago. So yep. Like 50 years in a week
yeah.
or so.
Yeah.
This is a ballad, but people misunderstood the title of this song. So much so that feminist groups protested this song, when in fact it's actually a woman anthem.
Okay.
All right. Now, this was performed by a guy whose real name is Vincent Damon Furnier.
Okay. It's not getting me.
Does that
anywhere.
Sound like a rock and roll name to you?
No. All right. I see why he might have changed it.
So, the interesting thing about this song is people think it's about menstruation. How many rock and roll classics do you know that are about menstruation?
Can't think of a one. Yes,
right?
I cannot think of a one.
when I tell you the title of the song, you'll be like, oh yeah, I see why they took that meaning, but it's not about that at all. It's about abuse, like emotional abuse, physical abuse, women being dumped on by men, not being taken care of properly, not being loved the way they should.
Okay.
All right. Now let me tell you about maybe the most infamous incident involving Vincent and his band.
Okay.
Young up-and-coming rock band performing a concert. He's at the Toronto Rock Festival and somebody throws a chicken on the stage. I saw him interviewed. He's like, I didn't bring the chicken. I did not bring a chicken. And he said, I was thinking about, you know, there's some guy who's like, all right, I'm getting ready to a concert. Let's see. I got the tickets. I got my keys. I got my wallet. Oh yeah. My chicken. Right?
Right.
So he throws a chicken on stage and the lead singer of this band sees the chicken, picks it up and thinks, I mean, it's a bird. It has feathers. It has wings. I'll throw it in the air and it will fly away. Well, chickens don't fly.
Not really, no.
He said, I'm from Detroit. I didn't know that. So the chicken, he said, it didn't fly, but it did plummet. And so it fell into the crowd.
God is my witness.
Right?
Exactly.
Exactly. So the chicken falls into the crowd, and the crowd proceeds to tear it apart.
Oh.
Destroys the chicken, who was alive momentarily.
Oh.
And then pieces of the chicken come back on stage.
Gosh.
And so there's blood and guts and chicken parts all over the stage.
Uh-huh.
And so the next day, the guy that was kind of in charge of signing him, Frank Zappa, called him and said, did you kill a chicken on stage? He's like, no, I didn't kill a chicken. He said, I threw the chicken into the crowd. They killed it and threw it back to me.
Uh-huh.
This incident still follows him around to this day. Like, he'll go to festivals and they'll be like, no, you're not going to kill any chickens. He's like, no, I'm not killing any chickens. That happened in 1969 and I didn't even do it. So anyway, do you know the band?
I thought I did, but I do not. No.
No? Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. That's good. That's good. So this comes from a concept album. This was the ballad of that concept album.
Okay.
And it was about a young boy named Steven who would have nightmares. And the concept album was that you would walk through Steven's nightmares.
Okay.
And this was the soft release between hard rock songs. So the lead singer, Vincent Damon Furnier, called this heavy metal housewife rock.
Okay. Is the band a band or is it just really this guy?
It's really pretty much just this guy.
Is it Alice Cooper?
It's Alice Cooper.
Okay. And so the only song that I know from this era by Alice Cooper could not be the song that you're talking about. So you're going to have to tell me what the song is.
Okay. You may be more familiar with songs like Poison that came out in 1989.
Sure.
School's Out.
That's the one I was thinking of from the 70s.
So School's Out was his biggest hit. That reached number 7.
Yeah.
He also had a song called Welcome to My Nightmare, which this is from that album. This song reached number 12. This song is called Only Women Bleed.
Man got his woman to take his seat. He got the power, oh, she got the need. She spends her life through pleasing up her man. Feeds him dinner, oh, anything she can. She cries.
So, not familiar with the song. Beautiful song, though.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, very pretty.
You said it sounded like
Silent Lucidity by Queensryche.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
It does. Okay.
I love it. And in fact, Lita Ford's got a great version of this song. If you
I could totally, see that for sure. Yeah.
All right.
All right. My turn. My
number five. You're number five.
All right. Here we go. Okay. My number five is a gospel song.
Okay.
Well, it was a gospel song. It was originally recorded back in the 20s, and there's a lot of kind of versions of the song, and the authorship is sort of unknown, but the first guy to record it was a Reverend J.C. Burnett, but it never got issued. So the guy who gets the credit for having first recorded the music is Blind Willie Johnson. Blind Willie is a big influence on a whole lot of the guys in the 70s, right?
I love old school, you know, blues guys and Blind Willie Johnson.
Yes. So it is inspired by Psalm 41, verse 3.
Okay.
The Lord will strengthen him upon the bed of languishing. Thou wilt make all his bed in his sickness. That song has been covered by Bob Dylan, and it has also been covered by another band in the 70s, which is the version that I'm talking about today.
Okay.
Okay, this song comes from their 6th studio album, and And when this sixth studio album came out, all of their albums went back into the top 200 albums.
Okay.
You will know the band for sure. I don't know that you're going to know this song. Most people, if they were thinking, okay, best songs of 1975, would pick a different song from this album.
Right.
And as you may know, a lot of bands didn't really release a whole lot of singles. The only single that came off of this one was a single called Trampled Underfoot. Heard of that?
Okay, that's fantastic because this goes right into my number four. Trampled Underfoot is not one I was very familiar with. Mm-hmm. Keep going.
So you know who the band is.
I do.
You know what the album is.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to give the listeners a little bit more, okay? So this one was released on February 24th, 1975. It's over 11 minutes long. It is the longest studio track they had, which is saying something because they had
a long
studio track. The album, even though this song was obviously a cover of the Blind Willie Johnson song, credits the four members of the band as the authors of the song.
Really?
But they didn't write it.
Okay.
This one, the lead guitarist is playing a Dan Electro short horn, which is a different kind of guitar than he normally played. Usually he was playing a Gibson Les Paul, but he's playing in an open A tuning, which is E, A, E, A, C sharp, and E. This is the same tuning that Jack White of the White Stripes used on the Seven Nation Army song, which if you're a younger viewer, you may know that one a little bit better.
Right.
The bass player played a fretless bass on this one. And okay. Rick Rubin said, the bass line in the fast grooves is so interesting and unexpected, it keeps shifting gears over and over. The drums use the same reverb effect that the drummer used in what I would call the drum introduction of all songs of all time, off one of their earlier albums.
Okay.
But the song was great, but this lead singer wasn't super excited about performing it live because the name of the song has to do with dying, and he had actually almost died himself in a car crash just before they had recorded this song. And so once they started doing live shows, he felt kind of uncomfortable covering this song.
Okay.
The guitarist, after this band split up, the guitarist has since played this song with David Coverdale.
Probably had that album.
Uh-huh. He's also played it with the Black Crowes, Live at the Greek.
Hey, I know exactly who we're talking about.
All right, very good.
This is the same one that Rich Robinson said, take a hike, we don't want your ideas.
Yes, that's that guitarist.
Yes,
that's right. All right, and the song that most people are thinking about from this album relates to a place that makes me think of a sweater, but I won't go into that because it may be your number four.
We'll talk about that one here in a second.
Okay. And so can you tell me who the band is?
This is Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
And I have no idea what the song is.
Tell me the album.
Physical Graffiti.
That is correct. So this is off the album Physical Graffiti. The name of the song is In My Time of Dying. So much because it was one I discovered on my own.
Uh-huh.
You know, like so many songs, you've got somebody else who are like, hey, you should listen to this.
Right.
And so Led Zeppelin I got introduced to as a teenager. And so I came across the Physical Graffiti album. And when that song came on, I was like, holy crap, that is freaking awesome. The drum intro that I was talking about was from When the Levee Breaks off of Four. But I mean, it's just, that's such a good, the bluesy awesomeness and the Robert Plant screaming voice. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Led Zeppelin. Stand up, Led.
You know, that's funny. So just as an observation, you know, you said my song sounded like Silent Lucidity,
mm-hmm.
which probably is a trickle-down effect,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
This song that you just played for me sounds just like Falling Apart at the Seams by Cinderella.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I you can know, see that, that for sure. Bluesy, yeah. Which, as a coincidence, today is July 5th, and Long Cold Winter was released on July 5th, 1988, so it's actually, it's...
Hard math.
37th anniversary.
Yeah.
So anyway, that sounds exactly like that blues that Cinderella probably got directly from Led Zeppelin.
Absolutely.
Speaking of Led Zeppelin.
Four.
Yeah, it looks like we've probably got the band and probably also the album.
We got the album, we got the band.
Okay, so we're already here for Jason's number four.
Number four.
All we got to do is figure out the song.
So this should not be hard. And in fact, you probably already have it as right. It is. But this was released February 24th, 1975. It did not chart.
The reason that neither one of these charted is because they weren't released as singles. There was only the one single that was released.
Okay, well then, I don't know where I got this release date.
Because that's when the album came out. Mine was the same release date.
There we go. Okay. Well, that makes sense then. Yep. Okay. So this was written while the lead singer, Robert Plant, was traveling in Morocco.
Yeah.
So he's driving around Morocco in 1973, and he's in this desolate desert area in southern Morocco. And he's just a guy. He's like every other hippie out in Morocco. Nobody knows who he is. He's just a guy with long hair. Who cares?
Right.
They don't know he's an international rock star. Right. I don't really know how he makes the jump from writing a song about Morocco, and it ends up with the name of a region in northern India.
Yeah, true.
So anyway, I do think it's interesting. Every band member, all four band members, you got Robert Plant, you got Jimmy Page, you got John Paul Jones, you've got John Bonham.
Yeah.
All four of them say, this is the greatest song we ever did.
Nice.
And it's a rolling series of three notes that hit you like explosions.
Throwing it back to Jack White, who I mentioned played the open A tuning in Seven Nation Army. I saw an interview with Jack White and The Edge from U2 and Robert Plant, and The Edge was like, tell me about Kashmir. Fantastic banger.
I mean, come on.
Gosh, it's just iconic.
Did you know that this song was played at every live show from 1975 until their breakup in 1980? And I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that Phil Collins played this at Live Aid with Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and the other dude from Chic who was there.
Right. Right. Iconic.
Yes. Yes. All right. To your number four, sir.
Okay, my number four. So, interestingly, we are in America month this month, where we just got finished celebrating the independence of the U.S. Sorry, Britain. But, hey, guess what? Over half of my songs are by U.K. bands. Now, a lot of them were borrowing from old blues musicians from the U.S., so who knows? But this one, I will tell you, is not a U.K. band. This is a born and bred in the USA band, okay? Okay,
all right.
All right. This single was released May 19th, 1975. The single was 3 minutes and 9 seconds long, which they had cut down from the album version, which is 4 minutes and 34 seconds long. And for my money, every day of the week and twice on Sunday, you got to play the album version because the intro is so freaking awesome
okay. That
you can't just skip it. What they did when they cut it down was they kind of jumped right into the chorus. And that leads off with the chorus. It doesn't lead off with a verse.
Okay.
Okay. This was number 416 in Rolling Stone magazine's 500 greatest songs of all time. It peaked on July 19th, which I don't know when this episode's coming out precisely, but almost exactly 50 years ago, peaked at number 36 on the Hot 100. Number 36. Now,
what was the release date on that one?
The release date was May 19th, 1975.
Hold that thought.
Okay. All right. We're going to hold on to that one because Jason's got it coming up here in a minute.
Take it.
That's okay. Hey, that we do have some overlap.
We do have some overlap. Have
it. It'll be fun to talk about this one together. All right.
All right.
All right.
Let's
pause
on
my number four and we'll move on to your number three.
All right. Number three.
Three.
All right. So this song has an interesting title based on what the song is about.
Okay.
Okay. It was written in response to the lead singer's wife telling him, "You don't tell me you love me enough."
Okay.
He had this kind of backward response that basically was like, if I tell you I love you as much as I feel it, the words will cease to have meaning. It would just be, I love you, have a great day, you know. And so he held those words in an effort to make them meaningful. So when he did tell her that, it was supposed to hit with more emotional impact. This song was released in May of 1975. It reached number two in September of 75, blocked only by The Hustle.
Hustle by Van McCoy and the Soul City Symphony.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So here's the interesting thing about this song. The ahs, like the like the backing track.
Okay.
They spent 3 weeks just building the ahs.
Okay.
And like the oohs.
Okay.
Okay. And they had to use these giant tape loops to make them infinite. And when you listen to the song, it's not like ooh. It's like, it's constant and it comes in and out, but it's infinite.
Okay.
Okay. And you'll know what I'm talking about here in a second. Do you remember the song from the 80s? I want to be a cowboy.
Yes.
And you can be my cowgirl.
Yes.
You know the name of that group?
No.
Okay. Name of that group is, they're called Boys Don't Cry.
Okay.
They got the name of that group from this song.
Okay.
In the middle of the song, there's a breakdown where like there's no singing going on. Mm-hmm. And you have a person who comes on in a kind of a weird, like hushed tone and says, be quiet. Big boys don't cry.
Okay.
It's a very emotional song. Like when I hear it, I want to weep every single time. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Here's the cool thing about that little tidbit. So many people will probably recognize it off that alone. Okay.
I'm not one of them.
Okay. So they needed somebody with this kind of crisp, kind of sexy voice.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
And they're in the studio one day and the guys in the band are talking about, you know, oh man, I don't know where we're going to find this person who has this voice. And there's like a, and they turn, they open the door and the secretary, a girl named Kathy Redfern, comes in and says, excuse me, Eric, I hate to bother you, but you have a telephone call.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, that's the girl right there. That's who we want. Okay. And they had to kind of coax her into it.
Okay.
So when she says, be quiet, big boys don't cry, mm-hmm. she was the secretary at the That's recording
fantastic.
Studio.
That's fantastic.
Okay. Here's where I kind of, my mind was blown. Okay.
Okay.
So we've talked at length about two members of this band who, when the band broke up, they did other things, including direct videos and create songs. They did a lot of other stuff.
Okay.
Okay. Those two guys were, their last names were Godley.
And Cream. I figured that's who you were talking about there.
At the time, the band was being courted by Mercury Records, but they hadn't really signed and they were kind of in between record labels, whatever. And when they played this song for them, the record company freaked. Okay. And like, I've never heard this before. They said, this is a masterpiece. How much money do you want? Like, what record company says that?
That's, yeah.
Okay.
That's impressive.
All right. Any idea what we're talking about here?
The only clue that I've God is, you said Eric, and that's not giving it to me yet.
All right. Let me play this song for you. See okay. if you recognize it.
Okay.
Just a silly phase I'm going through. And just because.
All right, so the name of that song is I'm Not in Love by 10cc.
Okay. Yeah, that one I'm familiar with, but because of Guardians of the Galaxy. That was not in my...
For sure, right?
Not in my wheelhouse, certainly not in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. But yes, I am familiar with that. It's great. Good one.
Yeah. All right, to your number three, sir.
Okay, number three. So this album, again, only had one single off of it. Okay. I won't tell you the name of it because I think that'll give it away too quickly. But they had a different lead singer for that single than normally sang for the group. A couple of guys would sing for the group. Sometimes the bass player would sing. Sometimes the guitarist would sing. The guy who sang this song was a guy named Roy Harper. But that's not the song I'm talking about. That was just the single that came off this album. Now, the song that I'm talking about has the same title as the album had.
Okay.
Okay. Album was released September 12th, 1975.
Okay.
It was sandwiched. Well, it's there's another one. It and another album were sandwiched in between the what I would describe as the band's two biggest albums, which are two of the biggest albums of all time.
Okay.
One of the songs on this album has 9 parts. It starts off with like parts 1 through 4 and then ends up with parts 5 through 9.
Okay.
And I could have picked any one of the songs on this album as my number 3 song. I'm just picking this one because I happen to love it. I love it all. This is the favorite album of the guitarist and the keyboardist for this band, even though it's obviously not even their second biggest album.
It's their favorite album, but it's not their biggest album.
It's not their biggest album by a couple of albums. Yeah.
Okay.
It actually didn't have as much critical success when it was released, but has become well known as a classic album of this band. Okay.
All right.
The song and the album itself is kind of a tribute to a former band member that these guys had. He was a co-founder of the band, but he left the band about 7 years before that because he was having some significant mental health issues.
Okay.
Okay. And so
I was tracking, and now I'm lost.
Now you're lost. Okay. Yeah. So that band member, he did actually come back and he didn't perform, but he just showed up at the recording studio and hung out for a little bit with them while they were recording this album, which was a tribute to him. Okay.
All right. Interesting.
This song, in addition to being a tribute to him, and when you hear the title, you're going to be like, oh, well, of course, that makes complete sense. It's also, if you listen to the lyrics, it is also kind of the dichotomy of the guy who's normally their lead singer who wrote the lyrics to this song, his dichotomy of greed and ambition battling against his compassion and idealism. Because the band's popularity was really, really picking up steam at this point. The introduction is a guitar introduction, and it's a 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
You remember you sent me a video.
I did.
Like top 10 12-string guitar intros. This was one of those intros, okay? And the way this song comes in from the song that plays before it, it's like somebody changing the dial on a radio station. And so it's like you're listening to the song and then all of a sudden it's like somebody's changing the dial for you. By the way, Jason told me 1975, this was the year that they came out with the push buttons on your car radio so that you could jump right to a particular radio station.
That's what I saw. That's true.
What'd your dad say?
He said that was a huge advancement in technology. You didn't have to go.
So the song that, you know, as they're scrolling through, like they're tuning a dial, one of the songs that goes by is Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. Okay.
Yeah.
And then you get this 12-string guitar playing, sounding like it's coming out of an AM radio.
Man.
And then the lead guitar is an acoustic guitar, and it comes over it as though somebody's listening to the radio trying to play the lead along with the radio, because the lead guitar is a much clearer, stronger, louder sound. Okay.
Okay.
No idea yet.
No, I am lost.
Okay. So the co-founder of the band who left 7 years before they recorded this album, his name is Sid Barrett. Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay. I imagine a lot of the viewers have got it at this point.
Wait. I have some holes in my back history.
Yes.
Is this Pink Floyd?
Yes.
Okay.
Stuck on the song?
I know it's not Another Brick in the Wall, because that's later.
Didn't come out until, 79.
So this is from Dark Side of the Moon.
Nope. It's not either one of those albums.
I thought Dark Side of the Moon was 75. Okay.
It was 73 or 74, I believe, right?
Okay. I don't know. One of my holes in my back history is Pink Floyd, so keep going.
Okay, no problem. So we know it's Pink Floyd. We know it's not Dark Side of the Moon. We know it's not The Wall. This album and this song are called Wish You Were Here.
Heaven from hell, blue skies from pain. Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail? A smile from a veil. Do you think you can tell? Did they get you to train your heroes for ghosts? Hot ashes for trees. Hot air for a cool breeze.
That's a great one. I know that from classic rock.
Right.
I told you that my football team, we used to lift weights during the summers, and our football coaches would turn it to classic rock. And we were like, can you please turn it to Bon Jovi? Well, that's where I heard most of these songs.
Yeah, absolutely. This one is one that Gautier and I performed whenever we got our little group together. This was actually his dearly departed wife and my good friend Kristen's favorite song. And so it was especially meaningful since she's gone that we wish she was here too.
Well, it's funny that you would mention that because my number two song.
Two.
Is a song that I thought you and Gautier should play.
Okay.
All
right. Yeah.
So this week when I was listening to this song, I was like, oh man, this is such a crowd pleaser. This is such a great song. Like people would love this song that you were talking about. There are certain songs that you just play and just the crowd just reacts.
Right.
I think this is one of those songs.
Okay.
So I'll see where you come down on this. So,
okay.
You know, we talked about in our Def Leppard Hysteria album that the song Hysteria was the combination of two songs.
Yeah.
So when they came back to the studio, Rick Savage had like a guitar strumming part that he liked and that Phil Collin had kind of a picking part that he liked. Mm-hmm. And they were sharing their ideas and they're like, you know, I think these two things come together and make the song Hysteria.
Okay.
Same thing happened on this song. Okay.
Okay.
So the singer for this rock group wrote this song. He started writing this song when he was traveling America. He's British. He was in America in 1968.
Okay.
And he was just traveling around, hitchhiking, doing what hippies did, right? Well, he came across a girl while he was traveling, hitchhiking. He was young and free, like this girl, okay? And so he started writing the verses for this song.
Okay.
And when he brought these ideas to his guitarist bandmate, that guy said, well, that song seems to go with this song, but they're totally different styles. And when you listen to the song, you're like, obviously, like, it hit me like a ton of bricks that, like, the verse is slow and kind of quiet, and then the chorus is like, kaboom, right?
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm talking about?
I think I know the song that you're talking about, yes.
Okay. So here's the interesting thing to me. Roberta Flack had a number one hit in 1974 with the same title, but it has not, at least in my eyes, stood the test of time.
Okay.
Okay, Roberta Flack is Killing Me Softly, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
This band was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2025.
Yeah.
And the guy who wrote the chorus died maybe a week ago.
Oh, no.
So, what do you think? Do you have any guesses?
I have a guess.
All right, what do you got?
Okay, so my guess is that the band is Bad Company.
It is.
And the song is Feel Like Making Love.
Very good. Very good.
So I will tell you,
my
band, my original high school band, performed this song.
Yes.
At a church function. They were Methodists, you know.
Feel like making popcorn.
And at the time.
They
were
Methodists.
A little slow reaction there. But at the time that we were playing this song, young lady in the audience caught my gaze because she was staring at me.
Yeah.
And I introduced myself later that night and things progressed quickly.
Yes.
She became my longtime high school girlfriend. And this was our song because of that moment, of course. Feel like making love.
Dee's first groupie.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
So, all right. That's my number two.
Excellent.
I think you need to add it to your repertoire. I think it'd be great.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a great one to play.
By the way, I just want to say this. Yeah. The lead singer, Paul Rogers.
Yeah.
He was the one who wrote the verses. And Mick Ralphs is the guy who just passed away. He was the one who wrote the chorus.
Yeah.
I saw Bad Company in concert with Damn Yankees in 1990.
Oh, wow. How was it?
It was fantastic.
Awesome.
And in fact, I almost chose Shooting Star as my song.
Nice.
So
yeah, this one is, it was my top one, but you know, that relationship kind of soured me on the song a little bit. I had it on my list.
Okay.
It was one of those ones that was on the radar. Okay. So that was a great pick. I love it.
Very good. All right. You're number two.
Okay. My number two. Now, this song was first written and recorded in 1974 by a guy named Larry Weiss.
Good old Larry Weiss.
Good old Larry Weiss. The new version that I'm talking about is by a different singer, and I know you have heard of him.
Okay.
That old version was not super popular in the U.S., but actually was pretty popular in Australia. And as it turns out, this singer of the song was touring in Australia at the time that the song was popular, heard it on the radio, and he was like, I want to record this song. Now, this guy is one of the greatest guitarists of all time. He probably is the most well-known member of the Wrecking Crew. He was involved with Pet Sounds and many other incredible songs, okay?
I know who we're talking about.
All right. This song has David Paich on the piano.
David Paich of Toto.
You got it. It also has a 12-string guitar, which is being played by the singer-guitarist that I'm referring to.
Yes.
And it's the first song to have hit number one in both the country hits and the Hot 100 at the same time. It had been number one on the Hot 100 and then got beat out by Loretta Lynn, I believe, some song that she had. And then it came back to the number one spot. And at that point, it had both spots. That was the first time that had happened in 14 years. 61, Jimmy Dean had it with Big Bad John.
Okay.
But
I thought maybe Jerry Lee Lewis did it with Great Balls of Fire. We talked about maybe on our Top Guns anthem. Anyway, keep going.
So after this guitarist singer died in 2017, this went back up to number 12 on the country digital song chart. Okay. Do you know who it is yet?
I think I do.
Okay. Yeah, go for it.
I think this is Glen Campbell.
Correct.
And the song has to be Rhinestone Cowboy.
Got it.
Yes.
Like a rhinestone cowboy.
I wore this song out as a boy. Like, I can remember holding that album and just listening to it over and over and over. Just love everything about this song. And somebody who knew Glen Campbell very well said this song, even though he didn't write it, this is all about Glen, of being in the throes of it, just constantly work hard, and not get appreciated, but know that someday you will be. And man, this really hit for him.
When I was making my list, this made my short list.
Yeah.
And I had a very distinct memory of being at Denny's with my family, and it was playing over the loudspeaker while I'm eating my junior stack of pancakes or whatever. Right. So
$1.99.
Yeah. Can I have a grand slam? No, you have the junior stack. So, but yes, wonderful song from my childhood. I love it.
So Billboard ranked this as the number two song of all of the songs of 1975. Number two.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think I know the number one song.
Okay.
Maybe we'll talk about that here in a second.
Maybe we will.
Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. We'll see.
All right. So we are to your honorable mentions.
We're on to honorable mentions.
Yes.
All right. My first honorable mention. Are we doing this 2-2-2-2 or 1-1-1?
2-2-2-2.
All right. So this song was released in November of 1974.
Okay.
This has recently come up. We've talked about this song. I don't really remember how we got on the subject, but it hit number one in March of 1975. I found that this song was performed by this group on a 1978 episode of What's Happening.
Was it the What's Going Down episode with starring Joe the Policeman, Randy Watson?
Yes. No, that is not true. That's from What's Happening.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So, but they were there to teach the characters about the dark sides of bootlegging.
Okay.
The dark side of bootlegging.
On What's Happening?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, because, you know, Smokey and the Bandit showed it pretty in a pretty good light, you know?
Yeah, Dukes of Hazzard, I guess, right?
So this song was written and performed by the lead guitarist, Patrick Simmons. Okay. You know this group with a different singer, probably.
Yeah, so I think I know which one you're talking about.
Okay.
And I'm pleased because it eliminated, I had three. I was going there, right?
Yeah.
Pat Simmons was the lead guitarist for the Doobie Brothers.
Yes.
And if it's the song that I'm thinking of, they were in between takes on the Captain and Me album that they were recording, and he was just fiddling around with his guitar, and Ted Templeman, who you know from Van Halen.
Absolutely.
He was, you know, hit the little sound, you know, the sound booth recording microphone, said, what's that? What are you playing there? Uh-huh. And he says, oh, it's just something I'm working on. He said, you need to make that a song. And so went down to New Orleans.
Yes.
Listened to some funky Dixieland
music.
That's
it. You got it.
This song is Blackwater by the Doobie Brothers. Blackwater, keep on rolling. Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me? Yeah, keep on shining your light. Gonna make everything great. Mama gonna make everything all right. And I ain't got no worries, 'cause I ain't in no hurry at all. This was a B-side. This is the song, you know, we hear this every once in a while, we come across this, where it was on the B-side of another song. The other song was called Another Park, Another Sunday, which mm-hmm. I don't remember.
Right.
But, you know, a radio station in Minnesota gets a hold of it and starts playing it and becomes a hit there. And then another radio station. And then next thing you know, it's across America. So Blackwater, it was a B until it became an A.
This is such an incredibly good song. I mean, you listen to the little plinkly little wind chimes come in. And then in the middle of the song, you get that excellent acapella of those guys singing. You love that.
It's so fun, man.
So it's such, just takes you away. I absolutely love it. By the way, I don't know if you remember, I can't even remember when we talked about it, but there was a point where Michael McDonald got super high and then went to his hotel room and saw Rick Moranis playing Michael McDonald on SCTV. The guy who got him super high was Pat Simmons.
Okay, there you go. All right, my other honorable mention.
Yep.
So this artist, this was his first number one hit.
Okay.
Of 13 number one hits.
Okay. All right. First number one.
This was released in November of 1974. It reached number one in January of 1975. So
okay. Early.
D's barely cooking at this time. Right.
Okay.
It was nominated for Record of the Year, but it lost to Love Will Keep Us Together by Captain and Tennille. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this song was originally written by a guy named Scott English and a guy named Richard Kerr. Okay. Scott English had a different title for this song. The singer of the song that I'm referring to from 1975 changed the name of the song because he didn't want it to be confused with another popular song of the day.
Okay.
All right. So the original writer, Scott English, when he heard this song, he said, I did not want to like this song. Did not want to like the song. In fact, I wanted to hate it. He said, but when I heard it, it was so beautiful. And then it went on to shake the rafters of the world.
Wow.
Okay. Now, I don't know if I'd go that far, but it was an incredible song. I love it. It's still, you know, Liquid Joy, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, he also said that even though he didn't like it initially, he came to love it because it, quote, bought him houses.
Right.
Hard to like something that buys you houses, right? Okay. Right. Now, here's the interesting thing. When they brought it in, the artist that I'm referring to, it was more up-tempo, mm-hmm. and he played it for Miles Davis. They did two different versions of it. Okay. Played it for Miles Davis, and Miles Davis, first one, he's like, hate it.
Uh-huh.
And so he slowed it way down, mm-hmm. pushed the strings way up, mm-hmm. really leaned into the orchestra version.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you the name of the song that caused them to change the name of it.
Okay.
So the name of the song that they were trying to avoid confusion with. So Looking Glass is the band. Brandy, You're a Fine Girl is the song they were trying to avoid confusion with.
Okay. Got nothing.
Okay. So the original version was called Brandy.
Okay.
You know the song better as Mandy. Looking in their eyes, I see a memory.
Barry Manilow.
By Barry Manilow.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So those are your two honorable mentions. Here's...
You gotta get no reaction from that?
It's Barry Manilow. No, it's Barry Manilow. I think, you know, we talked about him whenever we were talking about Nickelback and Creed. And I was like, there are artists that I remember in the 80s, Barry Manilow was like a joke. Like it was just, like corny,
yeah,
silly songs. But you go back and listen to his songs and you're like, well, these are really good.
Yeah.
Like why does everybody hate him? It's because he was so dang popular. Right?
That's right.
And so, yeah, I can't fault you at all for that pick.
All right. Let's go to your honorable mentions.
Okay, here we go. All right. So my first honorable mention was written by the singer as she was trying to support her guitarist boyfriend, maybe husband. I don't remember if they're married at this point yet or not.
I think I know what it is.
All right. he was trying to play guitar. They had worked professionally together. They had even played together, had an album released, and then their label dropped them before they could release a follow-up album. So she was a waitress and a cleaning lady to try to support him as he's writing music. And so she takes a trip to Aspen to see a friend, is looking out at the mountains, and just imagines this, you know, all of these bad things that are happening to her are coming down upon her like an avalanche or
a landslide.
You got it.
I took my love, took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around, and I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills till the landslide brought me down.
We just talked about Stevie Nicks on our Eagles episode.
Yeah.
Because she wrote a song for, I think, Waylon Jennings.
Waylon Jennings and his wife, who was his wife, you know, from, I mean, they got married in, I think, the 60s or early 70s, and she was with him all the way through. She had a big hit in 1975. Her name is Jessie Coulter.
Yeah, that's right.
And oddly, her song was a song called I'm Not Lisa.
We talked about that in our Eagles episode because I think I said, you know, you've got like Rocket Man and then a whole bunch of crap. And then and that song I put in the kind of the whole bunch of crap.
Yeah.
Category.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's smoking hot on the album cover, though. You can't deny that.
She's got them up and together. Let's
she
go.
She does. Yep. Yeah. She looks good.
Yep.
Okay.
I love Landslide. And I think, did the Dixie Chicks do a version of that in the 90s that was real popular?
Dixie Chicks did a very popular version of it. Smashing Pumpkins did a very popular version of it as well. Yeah.
That's cool. I think, don't quote me on this, but I believe David Spade was dating a girl, and somehow he knew Stevie Nicks, like, through... you know,
SNL or something, probably
something. And he called her and said, my girlfriend's favorite song is Landslide. And on her birthday, he had Stevie Nicks call his girlfriend and she played Landslide like personally for her over the telephone on her birthday.
That's incredible. That's awesome. Yeah. She has played this in every, since its release, in every concert, except for like one tour. It didn't get played.
Wow.
But in the last, you know, and she's still out there singing now. Yep. So in the last 50 years, there's only been one tour that she did not play this song.
Wow. It's a great song. Love yep. it. All right, your second.
Okay, second honorable mention. Okay, this is great. I absolutely love this song, and I can tell you how I became familiar with it, and I'll tell you in just a second. But first, at the time that this came out, it was the longest title of any number one song up until that point. There's another, like, later on, some song I never heard of that took the spot. But at the point that it came out in 1975 and the hit number one, it was the longest song title. Okay?
Okay.
It's got a little parenthetical at the beginning, but if you put in all those words, it's long. It was written by Larry Butler. And if you don't remember that, go back to when we were talking about the lady episode. He was the one that brought Kenny Rogers back from playing in clubs to being a huge country star. He and a guy named Chips Moman wrote this song. Other artists who have recorded the song include Loretta Lynn, Frankie Lane, and Ray Conniff. The guy who recorded this version of it, we talked about recently because he, I believe, was one of the singers for the Growing Pains theme. Do you know who that is?
Johnny Mathis?
No. Maybe I got the wrong.
BJ Thomas.
Yes.
B.J. Thomas. Okay.
B.J. Thomas. So in 1975, B.J. Thomas came out with this song. I, of course, didn't hear it because I was not born yet. But if you'll recall from our very first episode, my true first LP before I got Michael Jackson Thriller was
Chipmunks.
Chipmunk Punk. Not long after I got Chipmunk Punk, I got Urban Chipmunk. Yes. Which had a version, a chipmunk version of this song okay. on it, which Larry Butler was a part of that production as well.
Why not? Sure.
This song by B.J. Thomas is called Hey, Won't You Play Another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong Song.
Wow.
Hey, won't you play another somebody done somebody wrong song? Make me feel at home while I miss my baby, while I miss my baby.
I bet I haven't heard that song in 45 years. But as soon as you played it, I'm like, yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's in the ether, man. Yeah. It's such a good song.
Wow.
It was hard for me not to put that on my top five.
That's a good one. Yeah. I like it. I like it.
Okay, so I already know what this song is because he stopped me in the middle of my number four. But you guys can still play the guessing game and figure out what this song is. So go ahead. This is Jason's number one.
One.
Okay, so we've already established this was released May 19th of 1975. Mm-hmm. It peaked at number 36 on the Hot 100, which is an absolute crime.
Yep.
However, it was their first top 40 hit.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this same group of guys, after derailing the whole thing in the 80s, put it back together in the late 80s and went on to be one of the biggest bands in the 1990s.
Due in no small part from a crossover cover.
100%.
That came from the same album.
There you go. Excellent. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Now, this song was kind of born out of a couple of things. Desperation, because they had to have a hit. Drug problems. Toxic relationships. And a spilled milk incident.
The infamous
spilled milk incident. Spilled milk incident, yes.
Which we covered, but we can't tell you when yet.
So this song was written in part about the lead guitarist's wife, who would talk about things that nobody cared about. Right?
Yeah.
And then she threw milk on the wife of the bassist.
Yeah.
Okay? And that became a big blow-up problem.
Right.
Now, I will say this. In this song, you have the lead singer at the top of his game.
Mm-hmm.
You have the lead guitarist at the top of his game.
Mm-hmm.
And the bass line on this is incredible.
Yeah. Okay? The song was actually written, the music was written by the bass player. This opening bass line, unmistakable. Once you get there, you're going to be like, oh, of course.
Yes.
And it was the bass player's wife that the guitar player's wife dumped the milk on.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
I got it backwards. Mm-hmm. There you go. So you start off with bass marimbas, and then you have what's called a vibra slap.
Yeah, so the lead singer is playing the vibra slap on this one.
Yes.
And if you don't know what a vibra slap is, imagine like a little ball on a bar that's shaped like this, and it's thumped into a little box that's got a musical component to it. The third time he plays it in the song, it broke.
It broke. And you can hear it break on the record.
Absolutely.
And I've heard it a thousand times, and I'm like, hey, that's what happened.
Wow.
It broke.
It broke. That's why it makes that incredibly cool sound.
And
yeah.
At the beginning of the song, when they go to record it, they look around. Nobody can find the maracas. And so they can't find the freaking maracas. They're like, what are you talking about? We're here to record this song. Where are the freaking maracas? Well, they can't find it. So the lead singer looks around, and at the bottom of the box, there's a sugar packet.
Sugar packet.
And so he's going with the sugar packet.
Packet of sugar.
Now, if you don't know what this is, they re-released it in the 1990s along with a video. Did you mm-hmm. watch the video of this?
No.
Do you remember it?
No.
So it's all about phone sex. Okay? So you got this kid who calls, and he's talking to this smoking hot girl.
Yep.
And she's like, oh, Billy, what are you going to do to me today? And he's, you know, it's early 90s, so there's no internet and, you know.
Right,
this
right.
is the era of phone calls. And she's like, oh, that I love that, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the video, so you're led through this deal where she's smoking hot. The director of the video is Marty Coleman, by the way. At the end of the video, you see this fat woman, baby in arm, hair in curlers. She's ironing. She's like, oh, talk to me. Call me again sometime, Billy. Mm-hmm. And you see the illusion that it's not who he is envisioning.
Right.
So this song, of course, is
Sweet Emotion. How do you leave that bass line off of the song, man? I mean, talk about one of the best introductions of all time and brilliantly used in the movie Dazed and Confused as the opening. Like, you get nothing but a black screen with that bass line pumping away. And when the drums come in, the screen pops up and you've got the 70s, you know, Challenger driving through the parking lot. It's just freaking awesome. By the way, that Tom Hamilton had this bass line and he's playing it, and the drummer, Joey Kramer, he comes in playing, but instead of playing on the first and the third, which you would normally do for a rock song, he comes in on the second and the fourth. Producer Jack Douglas is like magic. It's just such an incredible mixture of sounds. And this is the most amazing part of it, right? This song, as we said, was their first top 40 hit. This song came out after Dream On, which is their signature song.
Crazy.
When Dream On came out the first time back in 73, it only made it up to 56. But after this song hits the top 40 and they do a big show in Central Park on the same day that it hits number 36, they re-released Dream On.
Wow.
And after they re-released it, it hit number 6.
Wow.
So this song really is the song that opened the door to what everyone knows about Aerosmith.
I will tell you this. One of our back catalog episodes that I don't think gets a lot of spins that probably should is we went track by track through Aerosmith's Get a Grip album.
Yep.
And we talk about the reformation of Aerosmith. We talk about Alicia Silverstone and all those great videos that we got. Such a great era. But 70s Aerosmith, big breakup, and then you come back strong with 80s and 90s Aerosmith.
Yeah.
And this, Steven Tyler said he wants Sweet Emotion on his gravestone.
Love it. I love that. All right. So Sweet Emotion.
Yeah.
Hits number 36. Would you like to hear the top 10?
Yes.
July 19th, 1975.
Come on. Let's go.
It's so nice to be the guy who gets to do this.
I never
for
get
once,
to receive
right?
this, right? Okay.
All right. Here we go. All right. Number 10, Rockin' Chair by Gwen McCrae.
No. No.
Number 9, Jive Talkin' by the Bee Gees.
Of course.
Sure.
Yeah.
Number 8, number one song of the year, Love Will Keep Us Together by Captain Antonio.
It's undeniable.
Yep. Number 7, Swearing to God by Frankie Valli. Nope.
Doesn't ring a bell. Right. Yeah.
Number 6, Magic by Pilot.
Magic by Olivia Newton-John. Yes. Magic by Pilot.
Well, actually, number 5, Please, Mr. Please is by Olivia Newton-John.
I mean, right before she hits it big with Grease.
Yep. Number 4, One of These Nights. Go back and check out our Eagles Greatest Hits coverage, which we did
a couple weeks ago.
Number 3, you mentioned earlier, I'm Not in Love by 10cc.
Not in Love.
Number 2, The Hustle. Van McCoy and Soul City Symphony. And number 1 this week, July 19th, 1975, was Listen to What the Man Says by Wings.
Little known song from Paul McCartney and the Wings, much like Spies Like Us. Right. Classic song that reached number 7 on the charts in 1986.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. Now, we're to your number 1. I think I know what it is.
Okay. So, I imagine for a lot of our listeners and viewers that they've got to be going, if you guys don't say this song, I'm going to be angry. So don't worry, I'm going to say it. It's all right. Okay, but at first...
You told me if I didn't include it, I was doing it wrong.
Right. But I'm going to tell you something that you maybe don't know about this song, that you maybe don't know about this song.
All right.
That I just learned, okay?
Yeah.
So this song was a very big song for the band. They were asked to play it on Top of the Pops. And when you say play it on Top of the Pops, what that really means is you mime it on Top of the Pops, because right. it was always lip-synced. You didn't actually ever play live on Top of the Pops.
Right.
Now, keep in mind, this is mid-70s, right? So they're asked to do it. Now, this song is a very complicated song, number one. And number two, they just felt awkward trying to mime this song. It seemed like a ridiculous idea. So they said, how about instead of us coming there and doing it, we just record a video for you? And they're like, okay. And so they record a video of themselves performing this song. And they do some very cool effects with the video where, and it's video, it's not film, it's video.
Right.
And so they'll do a thing where they turn the camera on like the monitor. So you get like a repeating effect, you know, it's a swimming effect.
Woo!
They have this part where the band members are in a Marlene Dietrich kind of pose. And the lighting is like Marlene Dietrich, which you would know from Vogue by Madonna. Yes, exactly. She's like that.
Yep.
And so, and then they would do a fade that they would hold over that of the lead singer with his big face on top of all four band members' faces. He's in the song, he's playing the piano, the recorded version of this. He's playing the piano that Paul McCartney played when he played Hey Jude. Didn't know that either.
Same piano?
Wow. Same piano.
Okay.
And so they record this video for Top of the Pops. And Top of the Pops, it's perfect for them because they don't have to have the band there. And so they can play it anytime they have an empty space. Uh-huh. And so they end up playing the song over and over for months, which keeps this song at the top of the charts. And so all of the other British musicians are like, hey, well, why don't we record a video? It's 1975. So this starts a trend of UK performers recording videos, which is why in 1981, when MTV comes out, a bulk of the videos that they have to play are from UK bands.
How about that? That is excellent. Good job.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Now, if you don't know what it is yet, I can forgive you for that because I didn't know any of that stuff when I first started looking into the song. All right. But I think you're going to get it from this. There is no refraining chorus in the song. The song was released on October 31st, 1975, mere days after I was born, right? Comes off of the UK's third best-selling album of all time. It is a combination of three different songs that the lead singer had been working on since the 60s, one of which was called The Cowboy Song.
Okay.
It was recorded on eight generations of a 24-track tape. And what that means is they would record 23 tracks, then they would take all 23 of those tracks and bounce them over to the last remaining track, and then they would record another 22 tracks and then bounce those 23 tracks. And so eight generations, 24 times, gets you in the neighborhood of 200 overdubs. They said by the time they were done recording this, you could see through the tape. Okay?
Wow.
It's one of the first things I learned about this song from my brother, by the way. This song mentions some interesting things. It mentions a stock clown character from 16th century Comédie de l'Art. It mentions a dance made popular in Portugal and Spain in the 1700s. It mentions an astronomer and physicist born in 1564 and died in 1642. It mentions a name of a Philistine god that became synonymous with a demon or the devil. And it mentions an Islamic phrase often recited by Muslims before they engage in their daily activities or religious practices. I'll tell you what those things are.
Yeah.
The stock clown is Scaramouche. The dance is the Fandango.
Uh-huh.
The physicist is Galileo.
Galileo.
The Philistine god is Beelzebub. And the Islamic phrase is Bismillah.
Okay.
Which, if you look at the lyrics, it's printed in Arabic or something. It's not spelled out in the English language.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And if you haven't guessed it by now, you need to go watch Wayne's World because it's an iconic scene. I can remember as a kid, as a teenager, calling the radio station and saying, will you please play this song? And the DJ going, I just played that like 10 minutes ago. Just in disgust, because in the mid-70s and in the mid-90s, you could not escape the wonder of the song, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy. I need no sympathy. Because I'm easy come, easy go. Little high, little low. Anyway the wind blows, doesn't really matter.
It's incredible. I mean, it's like one of the greatest songs ever written.
Absolutely.
And I told you I couldn't include it in 75 on a technicality because for me, the first time I heard it was from Wayne's World.
Right, but that's true of all of these songs. Well, like none of these songs that I hear in 75 that I have any memory of.
That's true. Anyway.
So you can't not have this song. Honestly, it has to be the best. I just looked at the songs that came out in 75, the albums, Toys in the Attic, Wish You Were Here, Physical Graffiti, A Night at the Opera. I mean, holy cow, that is a Mount Rushmore of incredible albums.
No doubt about it. So I told you, I've got a hole in my history with Pink Floyd, even Queen, Led Zeppelin. I'm not a big Led Zeppelin guy.
Right.
One of these days, we need to go track by track through some of those.
Heck yeah.
I'd love to do that.
Heck yeah. Okay. So there you go. There's our top five. Tell us what you think. Tell us what you think we missed. I mean, we had to eliminate some hard choices in coming up with this list. So we won't fault you if you're coming at us with Linda Ronstadt or
Steve Miller or Eagles.
Yeah.
50 years old songs.
Yeah. And they're still absolute bangers.
Okay, D, come back next week. We are going. That's true.
I will be here.
You and I will be here, whether anybody else is here or not. We are going back to the mid-80s Sunset Strip, and we're visiting L.A. to cover the 1985 album by Rat and the 1985 album by Dokken.
So this is going to be like Rambo and Commando for me. These are not either one albums that I was super familiar with. I mean, you couldn't escape Round and Round, but other than that, I'm not super familiar with either one of these bands. I mean, I couldn't tell you a Dokken song, I don't think. So this is, you guys are going to see me on my Dokken virginity and my, just the tip on Rat.
Oh my gosh. Two iconic bands from the early hair metal days. It's going to be fun. Come back. Grab your eyeliner. Grab your hairspray.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, if you haven't heard our other episodes, we did one on Best of 85, Top 5 of 85 from earlier this year. We've done Top 5 of 78, 79, 88.
89.
Yes. I anticipate that this fall we'll probably do Top 5 of 1995. It's just one of our favorite kinds of episodes to do. We hope that you are enjoying whatever you're doing. Maybe you're catching us on vacation. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week.
See you guys next week.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.